Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. It's Anne Wilson here, and I'm delighted to host Emerge Australia's podcast series for 2026, brought to you during ME Awareness Week. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, and those listening to this podcast today, noting your continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. When I consider the times in which we currently live, the lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine seem to resonate with what I'm sure we all wish for, and that's a world where the brotherhood of man is celebrated globally, a peaceful world without war, a world without stigma or discrimination, and a world where we have access to healthcare treatments, clinical services, good research, and cures. The lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine appear to be as relevant today as they were then. In this series designed to focus on post-exertional malaise, or PEM, our key theme for World ME Awareness Day, I'm delighted to interview people with ME/CFS to share their lived experience of PEM and the hidden harm of trying harder. This podcast series may include discussions on sensitive topics, including mental health and other health-related information. Some listeners may find this content confronting, triggering, or challenging. The information shared is intended for general informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice. So we advise that listener discretion is advised. It gives me great pleasure to introduce today's guest, Audrey, to you. Audrey is an incredibly inspiring 17-year-old whose journey with ME/CFS is a powerful one, and we're thrilled to have you share your experiences and insights today, so we welcome you to this podcast series. A little bit about Audrey. Despite facing significant challenges, Audrey has demonstrated remarkable resilience and a mature understanding of her condition. Her story will undoubtedly resonate with many listeners, especially those who are navigating similar paths. Audrey's ability to adapt and thrive, even while doing school online and managing her health, is a testament to her strength and determination. So to share her valuable insights into the healthcare system, Audrey offers a fresh and honest take on the good, the bad, and the necessary improvements that can be made. So welcome, Audrey.
Thank you so much. I apologize for my premature hi before. I'm so honored to be here, and thank you so much for hosting, Anne.
Oh, that's a pleasure, Audrey. Really a pleasure to speak to you. So with that intro, can you share with us the moment you first realised that something was wrong and how that initial realisation impacted your daily life and routine?
So, interestingly, I don't think there was a moment. It was a very slow build-up when I realised, because at first I was like, I'm battling some sort of cold. I'm battling some sort of teenagehood of being grumpy and tired. So I'm 17 now, and I began developing it in early 2023 when I was 14, just after I'd turned 14 and I was in year 9. So in the first few months, I would begin waking up and I just wouldn't have the energy to get ready for school. I would feel flu-y. I would feel under the weather. And again, I thought, well, maybe it's something with my hormones. Maybe I have a cold. Maybe this is just me being a teenager. As of course, all of we do, I was trying to rationalize what was going on. Then over a few months, it started off maybe once a fortnight, then once a week, then multiple times a week. And so at first I went to the doctor and after a few months, they diagnosed me with polycystic ovarian syndrome. And that was my diagnosis for a while. However, that just didn't make sense with the overarching of my symptoms, of course, of some of them, but of the extreme fatigue, brain fog, you know, pain, all of those, it didn't make sense. So into 2024, where I was getting much sicker, I was rarely attending school. I was extremely behind. During school hours, I was needing to take an hour to go to sick bay to sleep, which, you know, of course, isn't pleasant for anyone involved. And I kept searching, I kept looking, and eventually my doctors were like, well, maybe we should look for some sort of chronic condition, because before it was, maybe it's a period, maybe you have a vitamin deficiency. It was hundreds is an exaggeration, but hundreds of hours of just learning that, well, that's not what's wrong with me. And so it got to a point where I was like, maybe there's nothing wrong with me. Maybe I'm making this up. And it affected my life so deeply because I was no longer going to school every day. I was no longer going out with my friends. I was no longer having energy to be with my family for long amounts of time. And so it wasn't necessarily a moment, but a slow extension of the realization over about a year, I would say.
Wow. But you knew there was something wrong, didn't you?
In my heart of hearts, I knew something was wrong. It was like my heart knew that I had a chronic condition. I actually kind of pinpointed CFS in about, because I was diagnosed at the end of 2024, but I pinpointed it in early 2024. I said, when I learned what it was, I went, that makes sense. That's all the symptoms I have. But the doctors were just so resistant to there something being genuinely wrong outside of my period, about outside of being a teenager, about outside of being a woman. It was, so my brain started to, like my heart knew, but my brain started to tell myself there was nothing wrong.
Yeah, you've just raised, this is one of those times when I'm going to just meander a little bit. You've just raised an important issue specifically for women with ME/CFS. And out of the 250,000 people with ME/CFS, 75% are female. So there will be many women who will have been told it might have something to do with your period. And how does that make you feel when in your heart of hearts you go, I don't think so?
Honestly, a little crazy. It genuinely makes you feel like at a certain point after the, you know, fourth or fifth doctor has told you there's nothing going wrong, like your reality doesn't even exist. You're waking up every day, regardless of your period, regardless what phase of your hormonal cycle you're in. There are these so many other symptoms that have no correlation to your uterus or anything, yet it's all being pinpointed into this. You're diagnosed with a condition that, yes, may explain the symptoms of your period, but what about the rest of the month? What about all these other symptoms? You start to feel so gaslit to the point where you genuinely start to believe that maybe I thought that my brain was making me sick, because no doctors seem to be able to pinpoint anything. So it genuinely feels like you're going crazy at a certain point.
And does that feeling of they don't believe me, what does that do to you?
It breaks you down as a person. Honestly, I'm now at a point where I have a lot of safety measures in place for that. But for the first few years, and even I only really, it makes you feel like a lab rat, truly, is that they don't believe you and they're just going to poke and push until they find what it is. And they don't care, you'll know, they'll put you on a random medication. They don't care the consequences it has for you. They don't care how many months you have to wait or how sick you get in the meantime. You feel really like a lab rat, like it really does strip you of your humanity to a level.
Yeah, so what you're really saying is they haven't got a clue. And so they're going, let's see if it's this.
And let's
prescribe this medication. And if it works, then it must be that.
Yes.
But if it doesn't work, well, we'll have to try something again. And then at the end of the day, well, it's probably all hormonal anyway. I mean, I think that it would make me so angry.
It really does.
Yeah, yeah, because the frustration of not being believed.
Truly. And of something that it's not just in my, you know, my family members, my loved ones are witnessing this. They can, you know, I go to all my appointments with my parents, but they're not believing me. They're not believing my parents, my other doctors who believe me. Still to this day, when I'm diagnosed, I have people who just flat out don't believe that I have it, which it was even 10x that before I was diagnosed. Because if they, once I, honestly, the PCOS diagnosis kind of made it worse, because at that point they could pin everything on that. When I was like, but there's no record of people with PCOS having these symptoms. So why are we not looking for something deeper? So you have to push for them to even give you the medication, push and push for them to even try to help you. And then when they do, they're like, oh, I'll try this. Eh, that'll work or it won't. It's not, okay, well, how do we genuinely address this?
Yeah, you've raised another important point, and that is how critical it is that patients do some of their own research, because we hear often that it is actually the patients that go to the doctor and say, look, I've looked up all of these symptoms, and do you think it could be this? The thing that I find really important is to have an empowered patient. And at the tender age of what would have been 15, 16, when you were going to the doctor and saying, no, it's not that, congratulations to you for doing the research and going back and empowering your doctor with the information that you knew that ultimately may have helped to taking you seriously. Would that
I think so. Solution? You know, I take big notebooks of all my symptoms and I, you know, take a history of all my symptoms to every appointment.
So, Audrey, it sounds like from what you're saying that you are a very empowered patient, and it seems to me that you do what so many of the people that I speak to tell me. They arm themselves with all the information that they need before going to their doctor, and they basically say, look, these are my symptoms and this is what I think I've got. And that's a way that they've got around feeling gaslit and disempowered. Is that the way you see it?
Absolutely. I think that I wasn't even taken seriously at the point where I'd realized that this is what I almost 100% have, to the point where I brought it to a very respected person in their field. And I said, laid out all my symptoms. And I said, this is, you know, what they correlate. That is not a word. Correlate. There we go. With this is, you know, the studies, this is that. And to my face and to my mother's face, he quite literally said, oh, that's absolutely what you have, but there's no point in diagnosing you. You'll grow out of it. It was even at that point when you can show the evidence and you're bringing it to someone who works with people with it all day and saying that, are we on the same page here? Is there something I'm missing? And to be like, yes, and no one cares. I've known so many people who've gone through like, well, you probably have that, but what's the point? We don't know.
Yeah, I find that unbelievable. I mean, years and years and years ago, and it's very many years ago, when I was a teenager, people used to say exactly the same. And they'd say, you'll grow out of it. Doctors used to say to my children when they had growing pains, you'll grow out of it. It's really cop-out, isn't it?
Yeah. It excuses them from doing their own job. And also he just said, in the next few years, and I'm now the age 17, he said, by the time you're 17, it will go away. I was 15 when he said this. So do you think it's acceptable for a 15-year-old to spend 2 years with a debilitating chronic illness without any treatment or without any help? Because you think without any research that it's going to go away. That's just not acceptable.
Yeah, I think that is going to go down out of this podcast as a really critical point around the use of you'll grow out of it. I think that is such a really important point, especially for young people to hear. So that's something that no one else has raised, but it is indicative, really, of the lack of knowledge
yes.
that clinicians have and their lack of understanding of what it means to be A, living with an energy-limiting disease like ME/CFS, and then B, having to cope with post-exertional malaise.
It truly, it's the thing of, well, all teenagers are tired. All teenagers are grumpy. All teenagers get, you know, aches and pains. But we actually, again, also, even if it was something that applies to many teenagers, it sounds to me like actually maybe you're just not treating a lot of teenagers. It's actually not healthy or normal for so many people to be unwell in their youth. It sounds to me like maybe you're just gaslighting so many younger people to the point where we think it's normal.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I ask you whether there was a precipitating illness before you started noticing that something was not right that you feel may have led to your ME/CFS? For example, did you have a viral infection? Did you get glandular fever? Did you get the flu? Was there any infection-associated disease that was came before your ME/CFS, or did you just start getting energy limitations that have now been diagnosed as ME/CFS?
So I actually, well, again, it's possible that I had something in my system that I wasn't aware of, but as a child and before this, I was very healthy. I rarely got sick. I had a very strong immune system. So in my perspective, again, I have no clue of knowing what's inside my body, but I was not ill before any of this happened. I didn't have even a minor cold before that.
Yeah, because there are many young people who do, you know, usually in later teens get glandular fever or Epstein-Barr virus, and that can often be a precursor to their ME/CFS. So I just wondered whether you were in that category, but you're clearly not. Can I ask you, with your condition that you've currently got, what a typical day looks like for you, and how do you navigate the balance between managing your energy levels and doing the things that you want to do, your passions or interests, commitments, etc.?
I'm in a little bit of a funny period at the moment, because I'm recovering about a month and a half ago, maybe a little longer now. I had emergency appendectomy. So I'm, again, even lower energy than usual. So for the last little while, it truly has been, there hasn't been much space for my interests or passions. I'm finally getting back to a point where I kind of am. And also I've now officially left school. So I was in an in-between period for a while where I wasn't able to do school. I was extremely ill. I was spending every holiday catching up, transitioned to getting really sick with my appendectomy, with all of that, and then going, I actually need to really take a step back. So an average day in my life, if I get to sleep, because I also have insomnia, as so many of us do with CFS, I will usually wake up quite late in the day, maybe like 11 to 1. Usually I'm quite a late sleeper just because of how tired I am. I usually try to prioritize food as soon as I wake up, because I find that's one of the few things that even helps a little bit, is making, but also I have nausea. So I try and prioritize food, and I try and prioritize all of the things I need to do to stay alive first, like showering, eating, having my medication before I go into the other things, just because I found when, you know, I've tried to do it the other way around, I end up too drained to even do the things that I need to do just for my health and well-being. So I often, usually after that, maybe I showered, would have a midday nap. I love it. Or afternoon nap to my midday. And then from bed, I do a lot of things. So I really love journaling. So I will usually do that in the later afternoon. I love, you know, playing little games like little Nintendo, like, you know, Animal Crossing, Pretty Party Princess, children's games. But I also listen and read a lot, I would say. And then I would have another nap after that. I would have dinner. I would get ready for bed, and then I'd be in bed. So at the moment, there's not much going on in my life, honestly.
You've got what you've done, though, which will lead on to another topic, but you're disciplined in knowing what you have to do when in order to get by.
Yeah.
And, you know, it might sound as though it's the logical thing for everyone to do who's got ME/CFS, but, you know, a lot of people don't. I mean, you know, there's, for example, young mums with children, et cetera, prioritizing your discipline of doing everything you do when you get up in the morning and what you do when is so complex for a number of people with, you know, multiple people depending on them. But I think the message from you is that you need to prioritize yourself and your routine, because it's that routine that gives you the ability to try to get on with the rest of your life.
Yeah, I mean, again, as much as I love my hobbies and, you know, texting my friends or anything, I can't do any of that if I don't take care of my physical hygiene, especially with we're so immunocompromised. I can't do any of that if I'm unclean, if I'm not prioritizing my having good food and a lot of food. I can't do any of those things. So it doesn't limit you from doing those things. It actually opens the door to them.
Yeah. And regarding food, are there any foods that you prioritize over others?
Why? Because one of the things I can really have with, because I've had pretty extreme gastrointestinal problems. I prioritize a lot of fruit because it's one of the things I feel like I can have regardless of nausea or other stomach problems. I'm finally getting to a point where I can work on more of a balanced diet, because before, my doctor's advice was if you're eating anything with how bad your stomach is, that's what's keeping you alive. So I'm finally getting to a point where I can focus on having a mix of fruits, carbs, some meat or some protein of some sort. So toasties are great with some fruit on the side, an udon with some karaage chicken, you know, it has all of that. Those are, again, I have a very small repertoire of foods I can have, but figuring out how to make them balanced is the important thing.
Yeah, that's such another really important message, not just for young people listening to this, but anyone with ME/CFS and anyone really. A balanced diet is so important, and the role of the gut microbiome is critical in ME/CFS as well. So it's wonderful to hear how you're prioritizing what you put in your body to give you optimal energy, but also to not aggravate your gut any further. And you're not alone when it comes to gut issues as well, as far as other people with ME/CFS are concerned. So can I take you to PEM, which of course is a unique and often misunderstood aspect of ME/CFS. Can you explain to our listeners what PEM is, what it's like for you specifically?
So PEM, post-exertional malaise, is the extreme depletion after activities. It's a real, almost you feel like a corpse for most people after any form of exerting things. So for me, that shows up in needing to really lie down after showers or after doing anything, after being, you know, brushing my hair, of even lifting my arms above my head for too long to, you know, maybe do my hair to make myself feel better, even standing up. It's those sort of things. And I think people, when they hear that, they think of exertion as something very extreme, like a workout or cardio or going for a run. But for most people with our condition, it shows up at much smaller levels because we have such a small bandwidth to start with. We have such a small bandwidth and everything takes more. So once you've gone over that bandwidth, you end up in PEM and you end up just completely depleted.
Yeah, and then you could crash. So that leads me into the question around pacing. You're a disciplined young woman. Tell me how you pace yourself.
So I really learned about pacing when I went through the UNSW fatigue program, the 12-week one. Pacing for me, again, like I kind of mentioned before, is prioritizing the things, again, kind of figuring out the main things of each day, how much time I'm going to need in between them. Maybe, you know, a shower, brushing my teeth is the main thing of the day. So I know that I can't talk for hours and hours on the phone before that. I know that I can't, or even just my parents. I know that I can't have foods that are going to upset my stomach if I have something really big. I know that I have to really have a lie down before I do those things to make sure that I'm in the space to do it. And it's also, again, taking care of, so it's the priority of taking care before you do it. And then, of course, afterwards, of not, well, maybe I want to call my friends or maybe I want to play with my dog afterwards, but really looking inside and going, let's have a sit down, let's have a lie down, because if you disregard pacing, you will end up so crashed and you'll end up so ill and it's so awful.
Yeah. So, you know, disregarding pacing is really disregarding your ME/CFS, isn't it? And, you know, we started off by talking about the hidden dangers of trying harder.
Yes.
And that's what happens if you keep trying harder or if you start feeling better and you overdo it.
Which I think is the one I struggle with the most. I get a little bit of energy because one of the biggest things I've struggled with CFS, I've always been a little bit overambitious and there's always so much I want to do. I want to talk to everyone and do everything. I want to have a million job opportunities. I want to do all of that. So the minute a little bit of energy enters my body again, I will try and do everything. And then I end up so ill. And it's something that I really have, that's like one of the biggest things where discipline comes into play, of the emotional discipline of, I know I want to do these things and I know that it will make me happy momentarily, but what is the actual consequence of it?
Yeah, of course. That's just such a mature outlook on pacing and making sure you don't get into PEM and just managing your care on a day-to-day basis. You've had a lot of experience with the healthcare system. What advice would you give to others with ME/CFS who are navigating the system, especially regarding advocacy and ensuring people's voices are heard? But I guess I'm really interested in how best can we ensure that the voices of young people with ME/CFS are heard?
As cliche as it sounds to say, it truly is trusting your gut. You know your body more than anyone. No matter what people say to you, no matter how cruel they are, no matter how much they disregard what you're going through, you know, you have to believe in yourself, in the reality that you live. Especially as young people, we're even more likely to be, you know, disregarded. They're trying to get out of school. They're lazy. They don't want to work. Kids these days are so lazy. All of that. With young people, it really is knowing in your heart of hearts what your truth is, because then no one can shake it. Even it is so hurtful and it really knocks us around, but it is the thing that keeps you standing up. It's the thing, metaphorically, most of us are lying down, but it is the thing that keeps you going back for your own treatment, because it is so hard and because you will be knocked down quite a few times. And so it really is that knowledge that you deserve wellness, you deserve treatment that is appropriate and caring and informed, that, again, is also not being dependent on, I think a lot of us, especially young people, want to be the good patient. We want to be polite, which is, of course, very important. We want to show that we're one of the good disabled people, good, quote unquote. You know, well, I still try really hard. I'm not rude to my doctor. I placate my doctors. You have to get to a point where you're comfortable with speaking out and being perceived as, quote unquote, rude. Of course, always using manners, of course, always being polite, but, you know, standing up for yourself, standing up for other people, it really is ending appointments. I have had to end appointments before, which is not something I'm comfortable with, but truly saying, which might be conceived as rude, but it really is, there's nothing you can do for people who don't want to hear your voice. The only thing is you can do is make sure you know that your voice matters and can keep finding the people that do want to listen.
That is just such a mature approach, Audrey, and it's so important. And good on you for speaking out and questioning, because it's only through, you know, strong advocacy and hearing the voices of people like you and others that change, political change, is actually going to occur. And our current government is very keen to hear from people, particularly young people, who have had the kinds of experiences you have, so that they can address these things from a systemic point of view for the welfare of patients. I just want to touch now on how ME/CFS has impacted your social life and the interactions with your peers. And have you been able to navigate that? What strategies have you created in order to address that part of your life?
So it's one of the biggest things I want to work on going forward, because it maybe has been one of the things that I have maybe not prioritized in the way that I should. So I have two very, very close friends, which I'm very lucky to have. I went to high school with them, and even now we're both out of school. I think, honestly, it is also treating that as a priority, is just that little bit of time to talk to them once a week, of sending a text to them, of sending a photo of my dog. And again, it is treating it like a part of your health care and your overall well-being, unfortunately, because I think a lot of us, at least I do, when I'm sick, I just want to hide away. Even though my soul craves people, I don't want to feel exposed. I don't want to feel, it feels too overwhelming to talk to anyone about my experience. But it really is, again, very cliche, but showing up as your authentic self, being honest about what's going on to the people in your life, to the people you meet. And so they know where you're at. So being honest about how it's not maybe that you're being rude, maybe that you're ignoring them. You have to just show up and really kind of bare your soul to the people you trust. And that's all I kind of know about at this point, and because I'm still working on kind of branching out outside of my little world.
Well, that's a good answer, though, because you've got one person. And, you know, sometimes, you know, we talk about friends, and a lot of different friends are really important in a young person's social life. But sometimes just having one or two really close friends who get you, that you feel comfortable reaching out to, whether you feel like crap or not, is all you need to feel connected.
Yeah.
That sense of connectedness. And you're certainly demonstrating that even if it's not with a large group, if it's with a special friend that knows you very well, that that works for you, yeah, right now, which is really important. Audrey, finally, what message of hope or encouragement would you like to leave with our listeners who may be facing similar struggles at a similar age with their ME/CFS and their PEM?
As strange as it sounds to say, is that you don't have to be inspirational. You do not have to prove yourself to anyone. The only person you owe joy to is yourself. The only person you owe showing up for is yourself. You do not owe it to your family, to your friends, to your doctors. Of course, you owe them kindness and honesty and maturity, but you don't have to overexert yourself to be inspirational. You do not have to be an Olympian to be an inspirational disabled person. All you have to do is continue showing up for yourself, continue loving yourself, and that's inspirational itself. As long as you're keeping yourself afloat, it's inspirational enough for all of us. You do not have to overexert yourself. I'd say that's my main bit of advice.
And I'd say, wow. It takes a lot of maturity, Audrey, to be able to make that statement. And you do need to look after yourself, and you do need to, you know, keep yourself as number one. Is there any advice you'd give to people that don't have that amount of hope?
Yeah, really, I would say it's a practice. I would say, again, it really isn't something that's just born into you. It's something I've worked on for my whole life. And it's also, it won't help if you feel guilt for not feeling it already. A lot of us go, well, I wish I was that confident. I wish I was that way already. You're not going to get anywhere by that. It truly is in showing up in the little ways that starts to build it, in doing the hard internal work, but also in showing up in little ways, in brushing your hair, even when it's really hard. It is in showing yourself that you have that commitment, that you have that strength. That is the thing that really changes. And then, of course, doing the hard work of where do these insecurities come from? Because, of course, all of us struggle with internalized ableism. It's a really awful thing. It will tell you that you're a burden, that you need to do more, all of that. It is really doing the research into where that comes from within you, confronting it, and welcoming the actual love into yourself. Instead of keep guilting yourself, you will not get anywhere from hating yourself. It will not work. And wishing I was better. You can only start from love.
That's just so beautiful. I love it. What a statement that's going to be. You've got to love yourself, and it can only start from love. Audrey, you have been an absolute joy to speak to. I could go on and ask you a million other questions, but unfortunately, time will run out in this podcast. Would love to talk to you again about so many things. Thank you for sharing your truth, our listeners, and we look forward to talking again. So thank you for coming on to this podcast.
Thank you so much. I've been honored to be here. It's been so incredible for me and I've been so excited about it. I've been telling everyone I know.
Oh, cool. I really love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Today's podcast is part of our World Emmy Awareness Week series that Emerge Australia is recording with people like Audrey living with ME/CFS. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID in Australia. If the content of this or other Emerge Australia podcasts has triggered any emotional response for you which you need assistance for, please feel free to contact Lifeline 131114, their Crisis Support and Suicide Prevention Service. You can also go onto the Emerge Australia website where emergency services are listed. And there were a range of issues that were touched on by Audrey today. Some of you may not be able to cope in the same way as Audrey has, but if you've got any issue and if it has been a trigger for you, feel free to get additional support. So tune in again for our next interview and don't forget that for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter and lots of other things that we're doing, especially our new Pedal for Power initiative, hop onto our website at www.emerge.org.au. Audrey, thank you so much for coming on. It's been such a pleasure. And bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join.